The following program, Challenging Corporate Personhood, was sponsored by the Madison Institute in Madison, Wisconsin on March 12, 2011. Referenda on the ballot in Madison and Dane County, Wisconsin, in the spring of 2011, called for constitutional amendments declaring constitutional rights are human rights and are not necessarily rights of corporations. The following discussion deals with the issues raised by these referenda and the concept of corporate personhood. The discussion, led by Madison attorney Fred Wade, begins with his review of Tom Hartman's recently updated book, Unequal Protection. Wade continues with comments of the Citizens United opinion written by Justice Kennedy and the dissent by Justice Stevens. Wade's talk is then followed by a roundtable discussion which questioned the logic of the Citizens United decision, emphasized the threat posed by corporate personhood, and suggested ways of countering it. The program was held at the Capitol Lakes Health Center Auditorium in Madison, Wisconsin. Now, attorney Fred Wade.
Well, thank you all for coming this morning. We have two referenda on the ballot, April 5th, dealing with the issue of corporate personhood, to amend the Constitution of the United States to, in effect, reverse the implications of the Citizens United case, which gives corporations and unions the opportunity to spend unlimited treasury funds to influence the outcome of the election. Tom Hartman and I first became aware of at BobFest last September when he was talking about his book, Unequal Protection. So I thought with the upcoming referendum, it might be useful to have a discussion that would focus on that issue, the pros and the cons relative to the referendum questions that are on the ballot April 5th. I am a supporter of the referendums. I have been a supporter of the South Central Wisconsin Move to Amend organization. I've been representing unions for many, many years. The AFL-CIO's position on Citizens United was it was a good thing because it opened up avenues for union spending on political campaigns that did not exist before. I don't know if that position may have changed in the last year, but it's always been my feeling that that's a game you're not going to win. And that that position was not the right one. But I do come to this from the perspective of supporting labor unions and their role in the political process. So let's begin with what the two amendments on the ballot are, for those who may not be familiar with it. City of Madison has a question. City of Madison calls for reclaiming democracy from the corrupting effects of undue corporate influence by amending the United States Constitution to establish that one, only human beings, not corporations, are entitled to constitutional rights. And two, money is not speech, and therefore regulating political contributions and spending is not equivalent to limiting political speech. And then there's also another separate referendum on the county ballot. So that those of you in the city of Madison have an opportunity to vote on the question twice. Similarly worded, but it says it's more simple. Should the United States Constitution be amended to establish that regulating political contributions and spending is not equivalent to limiting freedom of speech by stating that only human beings, not corporations, are entitled to constitutional rights? So how did we get to the situation where these two referenda questions have been presented? It's part of what's covered by Tom Hartman's book. Tom Hartman is an author. He's written more than 20 books. Host of a progressive radio show. This is one of his 20 books, second edition, apparently updated and revised since the Citizens United case. And Hartman begins with a story of how the 14th Amendment was interpreted to include corporations, or to be more precise, not interpreted, but understood to give corporations the right to equal protection under the law, on the theory that they are persons. The provision that's been interpreted to get us to this position is, nor shall deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws. Any person. Well, if you look at the 14th Amendment in its entirety, it's pretty clear that they were talking about natural persons, not artificial persons such as corporations. Section 1, all persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof, are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside. No state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges and immunities of citizens of the United States. And then it goes on, nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws. Now, basic rule of interpretation and construction is you interpret a word in the context in which it appears. Well, the context is clearly one involving natural persons who are born. He tells a story of how he first discovered this case. It was the 1986 Santa Clara case. It's generally considered to have been the case that interpreted the 14th Amendment wording about the word person to include a corporation. And it's kind of a gee whiz analysis. And he says, I discovered they never said that. They never decided that. Turns out that the statement about corporations being persons is something that was in the headnote of the case, which does not have any legal precedential authority. And it arose from a conversation before the argument. Chief Justice Waite apparently told the attorneys in the case, we don't want to hear argument about whether or not corporations are persons. We accept that for purposes of this case. Well, they could accept it for purposes of that case, and it does not necessarily mean that for all cases. They never really went through a careful analysis of that issue. They never actually decided it. And he says that they never have since. Now, I haven't looked at the cases in between. Jane Ann Morris spoke to us here today, and she spoke on corporate personhood some time ago. And I don't recall, you'd looked at more cases, and I think you had said that they never had actually made that decision since then.
There are two other cases. That was 1886. There are two other cases between then and 1890 when they stated much more clearly both for the purposes of equal protection and due process. So, and then after that, it pretty much got duplicated in every case and then later expanded.
Because it was interesting to me when I read Citizens United, and I have not had an opportunity to read the cases in between. But they don't deal with that question at all. I mean, it's like the elephant in the room that they're ignoring. Because the premise is we've extended First Amendment protections to corporations because they are legal persons. But they never really analyze the question. They never really discuss it. Hartman does a pretty nice job of laying out this story of how the Santa Clara case was decided or not decided. There was always an understanding prior to that time that corporations were legal persons. When corporations got started in this country, each corporation had to ask the legislature of their state for a charter, which would define very narrowly their powers and purposes. And it was clear that their very existence was a privilege granted by the state. When the volume of incorporations became great enough, we went to general incorporation statutes. But still, there was this understanding that corporate personhood, if you will, or existence, was a privilege granted by the state. In 1819, Chief Justice Marshall of the Supreme Court made a famous statement that a corporation is an artificial being, invisible, intangible, and existing only in contemplation of law. Being the mere creature of law, it possesses only those properties which the charter of creation confers upon it, either expressly or as incidental to its very existence. So that is the context in which this issue came up. Now, Hartman points out that after the passage of the 14th Amendment, or the ratification, corporations started making the argument that they were persons within the meaning of the 14th Amendment, and that was apparently consistently rejected for many years. The actual Santa Clara case was decided on other grounds. It was not necessary to even reach that question, which may be one explanation for why they did not discuss the question of corporate personhood. But that is basically where it comes out. The book then goes on into kind of digresses a bit from what I think is the most useful or important issue, which is the question of corporate personhood and the rights of corporations under the First Amendment and the 14th, and potentially others. He talks about various conspiracy theories about how did this happen. I mean, it doesn't necessarily go anywhere, but it's interesting that there are four different theories about why you ended up with this interpretation. Then he goes into a historical part, which I quite frankly, found to be a little bit over the top. You know, the American Revolution for Hartman was basically revolt against the East India Company and corporate power. I know quite a bit about this period. I've been trained as a historian as well as a lawyer. I've been particularly interested in this period. The East India Company was a very powerful corporation. It may have influenced the way Parliament was acting. What it did, it may have contributed to actually precipitating the revolution. But theory of the revolution, the real motivation for it, was to assure that the people in the American colonies would have the right to determine what their own laws would be. It was basically an argument for equal protection, to be equally treated with those citizens in Britain who were represented in Parliament and could have Parliament make the law, you know, and the principle that no law could be made without the consent of their representatives in the Parliament. We weren't represented there, and the argument was laws can only be made by our representatives in the provincial assemblies where we are represented. So I was a little impatient with that. Then he goes on and he talks at great length about various examples of what he calls unequal protection, where corporations have had certain advantages. And basically, that's a bit of a polemic. I found a little bit in the sense of being a filler. I mean, it didn't really seem to help advance the argument very much. And it's not until way toward the end of the book, page 174, that he comes back to the Citizens United case. And again, very briefly, in just a couple of pages. This case was now a little bit over a year, January 21st, 2010. And as he summarizes, I'll summarize what he has to say, then I'll actually go to the opinion and give you a little bit more detail from what the majority says and from what Stevens' dissent says. Hartman says, the majority decision written by Kennedy was quite explicit, saying government has no right to limit corporate power or corporate free speech. Kennedy said the First Amendment is premised upon mistrust of governmental power, so that it stands against attempts to disfavor certain subjects or viewpoints. And this is one of the key quotes. By taking the right to speak from some and giving it to others, the government deprives the disadvantaged person or class of the right to use speech to establish worth, standing, and respect for the speaker's voice. The government may not use these means to deprive the public of the right and privilege to determine for itself what speech and speakers are worthy of consideration. Goes on, says, the court has long recognized that the First Amendment protection extends to corporations and contended that political speech does not lose First Amendment protection simply because its source is a corporation. The court has thus rejected the argument that political speech of corporations should be treated differently simply because such associations are natural persons. And that basically all he has to say about citizens. And then he goes on very briefly toward the end of the book again. He suggests, well, what can you do about it? And he talks, basically the remedy that he suggests is the remedy that people in Dane County are proposing. Local referenda asking that the Constitution be amended. And there are a couple of websites here. I have not checked them out. There's a proposed text of a constitutional amendment that's a little bit different from what's on the ballot here in Dane County and in Madison. But that's basically his remedy. Got to organize, got to pass a local referendum, and hopefully that will ultimately result in a constitutional amendment. So I think this is a useful book, but it has its limitations. And I think it raises some interesting questions, but it's not something that everyone might want to read all the way through.
So what are those pages we should read?
Basically, I would say it's about pages 1 to 50. The introduction is pretty good, I think. And 174 to 176, and basically the last, through 15 to the end, where it's talking about restoring government to the people. On the question of corporate personhood, very briefly, he makes the point in the introduction, and I wish he might have elaborated on it a bit more. Humans are born with human rights. The rights are inherent in personhood, being a natural person. Got maybe one or two paragraphs which addresses that distinction. He says, the modern corporation does not breathe or eat, can't be enslaved, can't give birth, can live forever, doesn't fear prison, can't be executed if found guilty of misdoings. It is not a human, but a creation of humans. And that's about the extent to which it goes. Justice Stevens, in his dissent, made the point, it may not require any elaboration to say if there's an important distinction between humans and corporations. But it's clear, given what the Supreme Court has decided and the way it's treated various cases, that they don't see that that distinction. It hasn't been a part of their jurisprudence. And so it is important to try to develop the point. And I don't think it was developed well by Hartman. And interestingly, it isn't really developed much beyond making those kinds of distinctions very briefly by Justice Stevens in his dissent. In many ways, I think, was a remarkable tour de force, although as I reread it, much of it dealt with kind of legalistic questions like the appropriateness of deciding facial challenge to constitutionalized proposals when that's applied in change, the implications of stare decisis, judicial activism, a lot of these questions that are kind of inside lawyer things that are important to the decision of the case. But and even his dissent really didn't, it said it's important to make a distinction, but he didn't really address the scope of the First Amendment. If you look at the Declaration of Independence, it says all men are created equal, and have certain inalienable rights. It's clear that the theory of the Declaration of Independence is you have rights because you are human. You look at the Wisconsin Declaration of Rights, a similar provision. It's very clear. You have rights because you are human. So how does a corporation have the rights of a human to speak? And that question has apparently never been addressed. At least it's not addressed in Citizens United. Let's look at Citizens United in a little bit more detail. The basic framework of Citizens United begins with the premise that federal law prohibits corporations and unions from using treasury funds to make independent expenditures for electioneering communications. And this is from Kennedy's introduction to his decision of the case. Electioneering communication is one that refers clearly to an identified candidate for federal office that is made within 30 days of a primary and is publicly distributed. And that was the provision that was at issue in that case. On the merits, they don't really deal with the question of whether corporations are persons. They basically assume it. You say Congress should make no law abridging the freedom of speech. And then they say the provision that is at issue here is a ban on corporate speech. It does not allow corporations to speak. And their basic frame is the prohibition on the use of corporate treasury funds is necessarily something that, quote, reduces the quantity of expression. Because they don't start with the rights of persons or the question of whether a corporation has a freedom or a right to speak. They simply say, we're dealing with political speech, and this regulation reduces the quantity of speech. And since speech is essential to the operation of democracy and the ability of a citizen to make informed choices, political speech must prevail against laws that would suppress it. Laws that burden political speech, he says, are subject to strict scrutiny, which requires a compelling state interest and is narrowly tailored to achieve that interest. Doesn't answer the question, speech by whom? Or who has a right to speak? You go on to say, premised on a mistrust of governmental power, the First Amendment stands against attempts to disfavor certain subjects or viewpoints. Prohibited, too, are restrictions distinguishing among different speakers, allowing speech by some, but not by others. Government may commit a constitutional wrong when by law it identifies certain preferred speakers and says that voters must be free to obtain the information that they need to make decisions from diverse sources. Concluding, we find no basis for the proposition that government may impose restrictions on certain disfavored speakers. Both history and logic lead us to this conclusion. And as I said before, they have the assumption that the First Amendment does extend to corporations without really addressing the question of the personhood issues, whether they are persons entitled to a freedom to speak. Justice Stevens wrote the main dissent in the case, and he really, in my view, takes the majority apart limb from limb. But a lot of it is with issues that are kind of inside baseball for lawyers. His basic premise is the distinction between corporate and human speakers is significant. Corporations are not actually members of society. They cannot vote or run for office. But then he goes on, and basically his basic argument is for years. You know, this idea that corporate spending can be restricted is something that has been understood or accepted by Congress for over 100 years or so. And he says it's the prerogative of the Congress, really, to decide to what extent a restriction should be imposed. He says the court today rejects a century of history when it treats the distinction between corporate and individual campaign spending as an invidious novelty that was born of a relatively recent case. That in this case, they decided to overrule. In fact, they overruled the Austin case and part of another case. For Stevens, he says this is something that basically undermines the integrity of electoral processes across the nation and is an example of great disrespect for the elected representatives of the people in the Congress. He goes through a lot of the other issues I've alluded to before he comes back to the question of corporate personhood. And again, it's a relatively brief discussion. He says, the fact that corporations are different from human beings might seem to need no elaboration, except that the majority opinion almost completely ignores it. Some of the differences include perpetual life, favorable treatment of the accumulation and distribution of assets. They may even be controlled by foreign entities. Corporations have no consciences, no beliefs, no feelings, no thoughts, no desires. Their personhood often serves as a useful legal fiction, but they are not themselves members of we the people, by whom and for whom our Constitution was established. The fundamental concern of the First Amendment is to protect the individual's interest in self-expression. Corporate speech is derivative speech, speech by proxy. Who is even speaking, he asks? Not the customers or the employees, not the shareholders, perhaps the officers and directors. But if you take away the ability to use general corporate treasury funds to try to influence the outcome of the election, he says, quote, no one's autonomy, dignity, or political equality has been impinged upon in the least. So that's the other side of the story. Now, the Stevens dissent is rather unusual, I think, in what it says about the majority. And I'll just give you a few. This is rather strong language for judicial speak, I think, so it may be worth going through. One point, essentially the five justices were unhappy with the limited nature of the case that was as it was brought before them. So they changed the case to give themselves an opportunity to change the law. Now that relates to some of the procedural questions that came up, which I think are a little arcane and we don't need to get into. But he makes a very persuasive case that this case came up in a posture where they'd never even had to decide this question. And yet they changed the case so that they could address it and reach it. Go ahead. He was joined by the other four, Sotomayor, Breyer.
I didn't understand
that. Yeah, but he was the author.
Right.
And he goes on, he says, the court operates with a sledgehammer rather than a scalpel when it strikes down one of Congress's most significant efforts to regulate the role that corporations and unions play in electoral politics. In the end, virtually every one of its arguments is essentially an amalgamation of resuscitated dissents. The only thing that has changed since Austin McConnell is the composition of this court. The notion that corporate political speech has been suppressed altogether, that corporations have been excluded from the general public dialogue, is nonsense. Those are pretty strong words for one justice to another. As Justice Stevens pointed out in Planned Parenthood versus Casey, he said, you know, the legitimacy of a court's decision, which is the basis of its authority, depends entirely on the extent to which it will be viewed as reasonable by the people, by those who will be affected by it. I mean, even if you disagree with the outcome, an opinion ought to be one that people can say, well, at least it has some rational basis to it. So when you get a judge saying, this is nonsense, that is very strong language. He says, the majority's incessant talk of a ban on corporate speech is something that aims at a straw man. It is simply incorrect, he says, to suggest that we have prohibited all legislative distinctions based on identity of the speaker or the content. Not even close. There's a little back and forth in the course of the opinions about the history. Scalia, Justice Scalia, as you may know, is famous for arguing that you have to look to the original intent of the framers in interpreting the Constitution. Stevens points out that the framers were truly concerned about the rights of individual persons. They weren't intending to give corporations any rights. And Scalia's response is, well, they didn't say that they weren't either. And that's the end of his analysis.
Wow.
I mean, it's just amazing. So Stephen says, the court enlists the framers in its defense without seriously grappling with their understandings of corporations or the free speech right or with the Republican principles that underlay those understandings. The government interest in preventing both actual corruption and the appearance of corruption of elected representatives has long been recognized. And there is no reason, Stevens says, why it may not be accomplished by treating corporations differently from individuals. And he makes this point other than observing that there are distinctions between corporations and individuals. He doesn't really argue that we ought to reinterpret the scope of the First Amendment based on its language. Freedom of speech, who has freedom, should only be a natural person. He doesn't really present an alternative argument as to how the First Amendment should be interpreted, other than saying it does permit us to make distinctions. He says, we have repeatedly sustained legislation aimed at corrosive and distorting effects of immense aggregations of wealth that are accumulated with the help of the corporate form. He goes on in pretty strong sarcastically here, saying in the court's view, two prior cases decisively rejected the possibility of distinguishing corporations from natural persons. It just so happens, he says, that in every single case in which the court has reviewed campaign finance legislation in the decades since, the majority failed to grasp this truth. The federal Congress and dozens of state legislatures, we now know after this decision, have been similarly deluded. The majority opinion was myopic and result-oriented, which is a way of saying, you know, they did what they wanted to do figured out how to rationalize it after.
Now we hear questions and comments from the audience with responses by the speaker, Attorney Fred Wade.
Charlotte?
Given the fact that corporate tax rates are very different from individual tax rates, so how can they maintain this fiction that corporations are individuals?
They need to be treated as legal persons for a number of reasons. One is to be able to sue them, to hold them accountable, to tax them. You know, so that there are reasons for having some corporate personhood, I think. So the question is whether they should be afforded the rights of an individual. And that should be, at the very least, I would think, a case-by-case determination. And the idea that just because they're an artificial person, they should have all of the First Amendment rights of an individual person or a natural person, I think, is something that ought to be decided by the legislative branch, if at all, and on the basis of whether there is any reason to accord some protection. But it doesn't have to be, as Justice Stevens points out, it doesn't have to be the same as an individual, at least as a matter of constitutional law. Paul?
I've heard recently that there is a background to the Citizens United thing, which involves a big money campaign, funded in part by people like the Koch brothers. Part of this particular conspiracy theory, that it was kind of set up, but they knew it was coming to them, and the court reached way down in the docket and pulled it out.
There are the reports that Scalia and Thomas, I think both of them, had attended some functions sponsored by the Koch brothers, and it is certainly clear, if you credit what Justice Stevens says, that they went out of their way to set up this case to decide it in the way that they wanted to. And it creates the opportunity to spend unlimited Treasury funds to influence the outcome of elections. And the implications of that, I think, are pretty serious. Exactly to what extent it's going to play out is something else again.
What I heard, remember, was that an argument that Thomas should have recused himself, that he was close enough connected to the forces that were bringing this case forward, so that he should have recused himself, and of course he didn't.
Well, and that's a good question. I mean, question over here, and then.
This ties in with that. I got a copy of a letter about a week ago, Public Citizen or Common Cause, and it was a copy of a letter sent to Eric Holder to investigate this. And they had documented both Scalia and Thomas attended this planning meeting a few weeks before Citizen United was decided, and they're asking the Attorney General to investigate that and see if they should have recused themselves, both of them. Mm-hmm. I thought that was very important.
The both Common Cause and Public Citizen have been very active on this issue, and are raising funds nationally to try to address it.
The 14th Amendment was passed after the Civil War to assure that the slaves, the former slaves, had the same rights as everybody else. Okay, the other question was, if corporations are persons under the First Amendment, are they also persons under all 10 amendments of the Bill of Rights? Because I've heard someone say that Walmart could come into any community and people couldn't keep them out because they're persons, and persons have the right to travel wherever they want.
Well, I know that arguments have been made. Jane Ann Morris talked about some of those cases when she made her presentation, I think it was a year or so ago. And Tom Hartman refers to other arguments that have made. So arguments have been made under different amendments. Apparently the courts, my impression is, have decided that there are other constitutional rights that they are entitled to, corporations are entitled to assert, but I'm not prepared at this point to really be able to answer in detail. Jane, did you have anything to answer to that?
I could say a few quick things which could give good references if anybody wants to look at it. There's two really famous dissents on the so-called personhood, 1886 and the two other cases. One's in 1938, one's in 1949. One's Black, Justice Black, and one's Justice Black and Douglas. One of them lists all the cases the Supreme Court had decided on the basis of the Hood there. And in fact, when I was first trying to figure this out, and I really didn't think I was getting it, I just went and read all those cases. And after I got halfway through them, I sort of got the gist of how they were using corporate personhood. So those two cases are very good references if you want to do it. Another thing sort of related is that the personhood problem is a two-step problem, in that first the courts declared this for equal protection and due process. And then the states went and wrote that into their own corporate law. And I don't have it with me, but I also carry with me Wisconsin's version of this in their corporate law, and I have Delaware's version. Each state then writes it in. So it's no longer just a judicial problem, it's also a legislative problem.
That's right. And just to interject on that, I think our state statute says all of the rights of an inert natural person, if I recall correctly, but it's very broad.
And one other quick reference, someone wrote an article, I think it's mid-90s, it's by Carl Mayer, M-A-Y-E-R, and it's about the corporate constitutional rights. It's a law review article, and it's kind of long, but it's all there in one place up to that time. And in the end, he has an appendix where he just goes through the entire Constitution and shows how corporations have used this or that different part of it. It includes the rights, you know, First Amendment, Fourth Amendment protection against searches and seizures, and it includes other protections that are not literally gone through with the right.
Yes.
I haven't heard you say about either Hartman or the dissent, Stevens' dissent, about the notion that money is speech. And that seems to me to be a wild overreach.
I don't recall that Hartman addresses that. And Stevens really didn't have occasion to address that. Yeah, that decision was made in the Buckley case. And Buckley I read in 1976, but you know, it's a book in itself, and I haven't reread it since then. Yeah, I think it's a very questionable assumption made on the part of the court, or assertion made on the part of the court. But I'm not in a position to critique it in any detail other than to say that at this point.
I can just continue on your point just a little bit. I just think that's so important because it introduces enormous inequality of rights between
yes.
corporations and us. We may have $100 to contribute to a political campaign. A corporation can easily let go $10 million if they want to do that. You know.
That's right.
And basically, their speech takes away our speech.
Mm-hmm.
And to broaden it further, it's not just corporations, it's also very wealthy individuals like the Koch brothers.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. So there needs, and particularly because now a lot of that speech is funneled through 30-second TV ads.
Yes.
And so money is incredibly important. Wins and loses elections depending on whether you have those ads. And the 30-second ads have a further problem in that they're too short to make any kind of intelligent discussion of the issues.
Mm-hmm.
They are strictly emotional appeals. And that all of this is intertwined to some degree to mean that having a level playing field that stresses real discussion of policies, of you know, value, you know, issues of great importance as opposed to emotional appeals to our lowest, most primeval brainstems, should all needs to change dramatically.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a given. You probably all pretty much agree with that, but I just feel so frustrated by what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
Feel a need to say it.
I was going to add a little discussion on the a case that was decided just, 12 days ago. Federal Communications Commission versus AT&T. Where AT&T was claiming that it had an exemption under the Freedom of Information Act because the disclosure of certain investigative records would invade its quote-unquote personal privacy. And there's a unanimous decision by the court. I believe it was unanimous, except for Justice Kagan, who did not participate. So it was 8-0, written by Justice Roberts. And I think curious in the light of the Citizens United case and what we've just discussed. According to AT&T, the statute, by expressly defining the noun person to include corporation, necessarily defined the adjective form personal also to include corporation. We disagree. And then it goes on in some detail. What is significant is that in ordinary usage, a noun and its adjective form may have meanings as disparate as any two unrelated words. Person is a defined term. Personal is not. Personal ordinarily refers to individuals. We do not usually speak of personal characteristics, personal effects, personal correspondence, personal influence, or personal tragedy as referring to corporations or other artificial entities. In fact, he says, we often use the word personal to mean precisely the opposite of business-related. But AT&T contends that person, in common legal usage, is understood to include a corporation. Roberts responds, the construction of statutory language often turns on context. But here, the context to which AT&T points does not dissuade us from the ordinary meaning of quote-unquote personal. We have no doubt that person in a legal setting often refers to artificial entities. But when it comes to the word personal, there is little support for the notion that it denotes corporation. So AT&T's effort to attribute a special legal meaning to the word personal in this particular context is wholly unpersuasive. And then he goes on, he says, but the two words together may assume a more particular meaning than the words in isolation. Personal, in the phrase personal privacy, conveys more than just, quote, of a person, unquote. It suggests a type of privacy evocative of human concerns. As I read that, I thought back, the First Amendment says, Congress shall not abridge freedom of speech. Freedom of speech. It's not just speech in isolation. And that's the way the court in Citizens United apparently treated political speech being the end-all and be-all of their perspective. AT&T does not cite a single instance in which this court or any other, aside from the Court of Appeals below, has expressly referred to a corporation's quote-unquote personal privacy. That's an interesting counterpoint. AT&T has given us no sound reason in the statutory text or context to disregard the ordinary meaning of the phrase personal. Do you square that with Citizens United? I don't know. The Village of Sherwood Hills. My wife is one of the trustees of the board of Village of Sherwood Hills. And she introduced a resolution asking that the board of trustees urge residents of the village to vote yes on the question on the Dane County referendum of whether the United States Constitution should be amended. The reasons include provision of the Wisconsin Constitution that provides in Section 1 of the Declaration of Rights that all persons are born equally free and independent and therefore have inherent rights because they are natural persons. And they cite the Declaration of Independence declaring it to be, quote, self-evident that all men are created equal, and then they put in, and therefore are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights because, again, they are natural persons. Argue that corporations as artificial persons cannot give birth or be born, cannot read or have a conversation or vote, have no conscience, cannot be executed or imprisoned, and cannot speak or express any point of view except through the acts of a natural person. So that's the position of the Village of Sherwood Hills on this. Another thought I just had yesterday in reading Justice Stevens' dissent, which is relevant to the events of the last 3 weeks here. Some of you may have seen the stories that Scott Fitzgerald told Fox News that the real reason behind this effort to strip unions of collective bargaining rights is to defund the unions so that they will be less able to present an organized opposition and less able to support the re-election of President Obama. And I just happened to be reading in the course of the Stevens dissent, called the majority opinion held that the restrictions on corporate and union spending during election campaigns would violate the First Amendment because that would necessarily reduce the quantity of expression. The majority opinion added that the purpose and effect of those restrictions, quote, are to silence entities whose voices the government deems to be suspect. And the court said political speech must prevail against laws that would suppress it. The Stevens dissent notes an earlier case that had dealt with, and I think his language was, a transparent attempt of the Massachusetts legislature to prevent corporations from spending money to defeat a proposed constitutional amendment to authorize a graduated income tax. Stevens said, in that case, we said that whereas here the legislature's suppression of speech suggests an attempt to give one side of a debatable public question an advantage in expressing its views to the people, the First Amendment is plainly offended. And he noted that even Justice Rehnquist in dissent had stated that there was a persuasive argument, in Rehnquist's words, that the Massachusetts legislature had simply decided, quote, to muzzle corporations on this sort of issue, unquote. So I wonder if there may be a parallel there also. Dan.
I don't know how many of you have heard of the about-to-be-passed law in Michigan. This law gives the governor authority, in case of a fiscal crisis, to appoint an executive manager who could take over a school district, void contracts, could take over a municipality and run it. And the interesting thing is, executive manager could be a person or it could be a corporation. I think that's pretty chilling for any of you who, like me, were reading the newspapers in the 1930s. That's fascism, corporate structure of government, authoritarian. That's Mussolini's prescription. That's fascism. I would argue what we're seeing this year across the country, various states, moves really toward not just corporations having certain powers, corporations actually taking over the government. I really think this is a sort of Pearl Harbor, and we really need to find a way to fight it.
It seems like this election of April 5th of the Supreme Court, that's going to make a big difference if Prosser is elected, because it says in the isthmus, Prosser, quote, "It's imperative that the state get its fiscal house in order and send a message that this is a great place to do business." Now, he's 100% behind Scott Walker as regard to his policies. And I just wonder why Supreme Court candidates are getting so involved in politics. I thought they were supposed to be more or less above that.
Now, our court has been very polarized along partisan lines for many years, and the thing that concerns me most about Justice Prosser is the way he responded to the ethics case involving Justice Gableman, where Gableman's defense was that, well, the overall effect of certain ads that I ran against Justice Butler may have been misleading. I admit that. He said, but each of the statements taken in isolation was true. Well, I worked for 11 and a half years with the Securities and Exchange Commission, and it's very clear in the statute, you cannot make a statement or have an omission in a statement that makes what you do say misleading. You have to have all of the statements in there that make what you do say not misleading. It's kind of convoluted the way it's stated. But the idea is, it's no defense to say that each individual statement is truthful if the overall impression that you're communicating is false and misleading. And my understanding of the situation is that that is clearly what happened with Justice Gableman. And Justice Prosser voted to not proceed with the ethics case. It was a 3-3 vote, and nothing was done.
I don't know if you're familiar with the group in Pennsylvania. It's called the Community Environmental and Legal Defense Fund. Yeah. What was happening was that corporations were coming in and dumping toxic waste in their townships. And so what this group did is they helped these townships to write ordinances saying, in effect, in this township, a corporation does not have the rights of personhood. And in effect, what that was municipal disobedience to state law and federal law. I'm wondering what you think about doing that kind of activism here.
For openers, I would look at the Wisconsin corporation statute and change that provision, which says that corporations have all the natural rights of a natural person. And it ought to be strictly limited to make sure that that doesn't happen. Now, whether that would give rise to a case where maybe it would go up into the federal courts and they would say you can't limit, but it would at least raise the question and maybe force some kind of decision. We have to address that directly. Janet?
This work that Tom Lindsay has been doing has happened in over 100 communities in really small jurisdictions. Someone said earlier that doing a lot of approaches is helpful. It seems like the approach here is to raise people's understanding of it and get a statement by the public that, yes, we would like to see this national constitutional amendment happen and so on. It's sort of abstract, so a lot of these end up being advisory, but they are really good educational tools. What CELDF is doing is just a totally different approach. They pass a local ordinance saying something that addresses a problem like no toxic waste dump in the city or whatever. And then they attach to it this kind of inoculation that says, and by the way, if any of the corporations who want to put it in here think they're going to come to our courts and do it in this jurisdiction, we don't recognize that you have constitutional rights of human persons. So they have to either sue them or back off. It is a different approach, and I think
hopefully we'll all get to the point where we'll talk about a range of different approaches to address this. And, you know, maybe a mix of them is the best thing.
What's the name of the group again?
The acronym is CELDF. There's a million ordinances and examples and press releases online about it. And the man's name is Lindsay. Okay.
Another small step idea to be added to the laundry list of things to work for. Do you think it's worth trying to push the idea that in answering who speaks for a corporation, that shareholders have to approve whatever political expenditures there are?
Right, and I think that could be done either by shareholders through a shareholder proposal process, you know, asking that their board of directors adopt the policy that they will not engage in corporate political expenditures. Some have been submitted. I don't know exactly what the track record is along those lines, but there have been some shareholder proposals of that nature. That would be case by case. But I suppose another approach would be for state legislatures to legislate that corporations that are chartered within the state could also make no contributions without the consent of their shareholders. Doug?
The war we're losing, because a lot of what we're talking about is people have to go out and vote. It's the kind of information they have. And if you look at where the messaging's coming from, we're playing catch-up all the time. If you listen to Scott Walker, what does he say? He talks about giving people the tools they need that the Democrats didn't come to work. I mean, this is basic stuff. This is like the ABCs of they work, you don't. They get benefits, you don't. You're taxpayers, they aren't. So we have to realize that part of this fight, of course, is in the courts, but it's also in the streets, but it's also on the airwaves. And we need to get some of the language back. We need to be able to reframe some of these arguments, because we are losing that battle in a lot of places. And we need to do all the work we're doing and the good thinking you're all doing. We also need to get those messages straight and refute some of this garbage that's coming out, because it's polluting the minds of people. We're going to go out there and vote like the people now saying, geez, I voted for the guy. I'm kind of sorry. Well, yeah, don't be sorry. Get smart. And we got to get the message right. Mm-hmm.
Well, I think that's part of the reason why it's important to have referenda such as we have on the ballot in Dane County and in Madison to help educate people about what's at stake here. And I just happened to hear a report from the state of Florida about the governor there introducing his State of the State message, and someone that did a poll. Rick Scott down there is very similar to Scott Walker. I mean, kind of a young guy, came out of nowhere. He ran on this essentially the same platitude that Scott Walker did, that you can't spend more money than you have. It was to the same effect. And now he's introducing his program, legislative program. It's very similar to what Scott Walker has introduced. And a poll was done, 46% of the people, as of just last week, had no idea what his agenda is in the state of Florida, at least of those polled. And I find that shocking. But that's part of why it's such a difficult thing to deal with these folks.
I got a copy of the transcript of the conversation that Walker had with supposedly Calk, and it was the Buffalo Beast. And it's quite interesting, because now, a lot of it is stuff we already would be very aware of. But towards the end, when he's getting ready to close the conversation, he says, well, we've really got things moving here in Wisconsin. We are going to change history. And I think that's the sentence that kind of tells me that they really are trying to do something different. I keep wondering why so many of the legislators are willing to work towards this fascism, as Dan calls it, because it seems like that to me, too. Are they completely innocent and just think they're really doing a good conservative job? How many of them realize how close they are getting to something that's fascist? I don't have any idea, but I'm trying to watch that and see. It's hard for me to believe that the Fitzgerald brothers are really into that kind of thing. But they're doing everything along those lines. Do they know it? I don't know. It's just a question that I ask.
Well, you know, it's one thing for, I've been struck with the thought that what we're getting is really contradictory to the very idea of Republican government, which is you elect your representatives, your elected representatives come together in an assembly body, And there's discussion and debate, give and take, compromise, conciliation. And out of that emerges the policy of the state. It's not supposed to be a top-down thing. You know, we expect our presidents and governors to have a position, to have a program, to try to persuade. But the idea that everyone in your party should march in lockstep to whatever you propose is something that's, I think, antithetical to our tradition and our history. Jeanette?
When we were talking about whether it's ever appropriate to have corporations have certain rights and so on, and you explained, I think, really well that there's a lot of good practical things about the legal fiction of the corporation. I just want to suggest that one way of keeping those practical things without giving rights is to say in the state code, corporations shall have not the right to own property, but the power to own property.
Mm-hmm. Or the privilege of owning.
Or the privilege, or other things, and that way you don't even have to deal with the rights thing or whether they really have some rights.
It seems to me that what has been happening ever since Santa Clara is that we have been moving slowly and with increasing speed now toward a situation in which corporations and wealthy people are the new citizens of this country. You know, if you go back to the Greeks, the citizens were, this is true of Rome too, the citizens were a small minority. The vast majority of people were not citizens, did not have rights. And it seems to me we're headed rapidly in that direction. And I don't know what you call that, whether you call it fascism, I think corporatocracy or something, or plutocracy, or, you know, something on that order. But I agree that we're at a tipping point right now.
I think you're absolutely right about that. I think it is a tipping point. If this imbalance can't be addressed fairly quickly, I think it's going to be very difficult to reverse down the road. But I think it's interesting in terms of historical perspective. I mean, we had a similar situation in the late 19th century where railroads basically had bought the legislatures and the robber barons were dictating legislation. We had enormous disparities of wealth. And that was the context in which Robert La Follette started his campaigns. We had a situation where, when he started out, how are you going to get your word out? Well, it had to be door-to-door and leaflet. And that's basically what he did. And he decided we had to organize in every county in the state. So I think there's an ebb and flow here, but you're up against tremendous odds. And part of why they were able to be effective in the La Follette era was that he was an extraordinarily effective leader. All of this is a bit transitory. You can have a temporary success or victory, but that doesn't mean you're going to stay in that course. And, we are now, I think, going in the opposite direction. But I think it is an ebb and flow. It's important to respond to the challenge at this point. Okay, thank you all for coming.
The preceding program and other thought-provoking programs are available at our website. Go to www.themadisoninstitute.org. At our website, you can find two earlier discussions on corporate personhood, led by Jane Ann Morris, who also participated in the foregoing discussion. The updated edition of Tom Hartman's book, Unequal Protection, was published in 2010. And the referenda under discussion passed overwhelmingly on April 5, 2011. The views expressed here are those of the speakers, and not necessarily those of the Madison Institute or members of its board of directors.